This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Alan. And I usually like to start any meeting with a little prayer. That's my background. So can you stand up with me in a very short prayer? Just to get us in the mindset where we should be. And this is from an English prayer book in the 16th century. God be in my head and in my understanding. God be in my eyes and in my looking. God be in my mouth and in my speaking. God be in my heart and in my thinking. God be in my end and my departing. Thank you very much. You can sit down. So when I think about homelessness, the things that jump out at me, my impressions after being involved in this since 2008, is homelessness is controlled chaos. You know that from living in this area. It's complex, it's connectivity, and it's also community. And I think if you look at this painting, you'll see those same things. Controlled chaos, complexity, connectivity. And this painting, which is also the cover of the book that Ellen held up, this painting was done by a homeless woman in Austin. And I call it homeless. And I purchased it from her, oh, I don't know how many years ago. But it reminds me that's what this world is. And I first met Laura in 2003 when a group of us decided to go out and live on the streets of Boston. We studied for several months before we went out on the streets. And we had no money, we had no credit cards, we had no cell phones, we had no contacts. So it was a little risky. And it was not a field trip to learn about homelessness. It was a chance to get closer to God. So we were dropped off right downtown. And we kind of split. We didn't have a very large group. Maybe there were 12 of us. We split. And a few women went to a safe house. Being an old Girl Scout, I thought, I'm not going to a safe house. So I slept in an alley by a school that had a metal gate. It was really more artistic than safe. And it was a terrible wind tunnel. I froze that night and just whipped through this long alley. And I was determined not to carry extra things, so I didn't have a sleeping bag. I had a SpongeBob kitty blanket, and I rolled myself in a little ball and put this SpongeBob blanket around me. And I froze. I definitely froze. But the next morning, I went to the park where my friends were, and I said, mostly men, and I said, I want to be with you. If I'm on the streets, I want to be with you. Dead silence. Because they thought, what in the world are we going to do with a 60-something-year-old woman? Well, we want to go dumpster diving with the homeless. So Laura Tenier, who did this painting, was standing nearby, and she said to me, don't go with them. And I thought, well, what does she? And she was obviously homeless. I thought, what does she know? Does she know that I might be hit on the head, raped? And she said, her words stunned me. She said, they use bad language. Now, she didn't know me. How did she know that I was a grandmother and head of school? But somehow she sensed that I would be offended by the roughness. I raised two boys. I might have been offended. So she said, you come with me, which I did. So for the next 2 days and 2 nights, Laura and I were side by side. And she came to get me that afternoon to take me where she slept, where she lived. And if you're homeless, your spots are very secret for many reasons. Number one, you don't want to be arrested. You don't want to be accosted. You don't want anybody to know where your hiding place is. So Laura's hiding place was the second floor porch of an abandoned building, abandoned house, really. And she said, you can have the first floor porch. Well, I looked at the first floor porch, and it was broken boards and nails. I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. So I slept on the steps before the porch, kind of under a bush. Bad decision. I was covered in insect bites for days. At any rate, I was ready to bed down, and Laura said to me, I have two gifts for you. And one was a piece of cardboard. Tremendous lesson for mamas. That was my mattress. And the other was an empty peanut butter jar to pee in. I will tell you, I used the cardboard. That was it. I was not yet street smart. So I slept there, and most people go to bed quite early, and they get up quite early. Laura was up at 5. I got maybe at 5:30. And she brought me a stack of papers written in pencil on a loose leaf notebook. And she said, I'd like you to read this. And what it was her autobiography. And oh my, she had quite a life. So the next day, by daylight, by streetlight, I read through this autobiography. And Laura's life was not like my life. Laura grew up in a crowded hogan on a reservation, and she lived with her family, her extended family. And her job was to herd the sheep. Her family and her friends knew that she was different, and she was different. She was exceedingly smart and creative. She also believed that she was a woman trapped in a man's body. So her family sent her away, not because of that, but because they needed help. They sent her away to learn all she could about technology, and then to come back and teach them about technology. Laura left, but she never returned. So she spent the rest of her life living on the streets of Austin. Some of you may have run into her. Her life on the streets was quite amazing. She was a volunteer. She said to me, I can't give money, but I can give my time and my talents, which she did to her church and to many civic organizations. And while she was on the street, in addition to her biography, she wrote a novel that was set in the Ice Age. She earned a degree in engineering from UT while homeless. And she got a national grant for writers, which was her greatest achievement, according to her. So she went by bus to Dallas for this honorarium that she was part of. And she stayed in the first class hotel, not her little abandoned porch building. She ate banquet food for 5 days, not standing in line like she usually did at soup kitchens with food trucks. She talked with other writers, and she said it was the best week of her life. So when she came back with this education, this experience, the next step she thought was getting a job, which she did. She got a job, which lasted a short time. She worked in a lab at night. She also got a place to stay after 2 years of being on the waiting list for housing. That lasted a short time. Laura, like so many other homeless people, don't fit into a group. Their expectations of society are not necessarily our expectations of society. So when she was in her housing, her little housing place, which I went to see, I couldn't wait to see her. I saw a little gift basket of welcome to your house, and things you would normally have, new sponges and Windex and that sort of thing. I opened the door of her house, and it was just filled with trash. Used wrappers and food, and just stacks of things that she had hoarded. And I was not very Christian. I said, oh, Laura, we must do something about this. She didn't see Lucy was anything wrong. So the next 2 hours, we cleaned this little house. Laura knew that there were other people who didn't have housing, so she invited them in, which is a violation for public housing. You can have guests for 3 nights, but that's it. So she was evicted. Amazingly, she was never bitter. She accepted that. Okay. This is the way the rules are, so she went back to live on the streets. And living on the streets, I will tell you, is very hard on the mind and on the body. So Laura had a stroke prematurely, and she moved very slowly after that. While crossing the streets one time in our city, a driver ran a red light and ran into her. She died sometime after that. And she was a great gift in my life, and I hope I can tell you a little bit about her life. She might be a gift to you, to our city. She taught me so much about what it means to be homeless and what it means to be human. So I kept going back since 2003. I was drawn to the homeless community. I was drawn to homeless individuals. I couldn't fill my soul enough with these people, and I wanted to be part of them.
Rick has no legs,
and he lives under an overpass. He does have a wheelchair. I've been trying to get him off the streets for 5 or more years, and he said, I cannot give up my freedom. So there's a lot of reasons why people live on the streets that you and I would not necessarily imagine. And you're also probably wondering, who are these people that are on the streets? And again, this is not a study. This is not a professional. This is just people that I know. These are some people, whoops, gotta go back, sorry. Who are these people who are homeless? Well, they're very much like us. In fact, they are us. They're men, women, children, teens, seniors. They're all religions, all races, all nationalities, all cultures. Like us, some are funny and some are serious. Some are givers, some are takers. Some are joy-filled and just pleasant to be around. And others are like Eeyore in their grumpy old time. Many of them are faith-filled. And I had to learn why. I think they're faith-filled because their daily life is so precarious. Where will I sleep? Where will I eat? Where will I go to the bathroom? Will my belongings be safe? Who will abuse me? So they need something that's bigger than themselves, something they can turn to, something that gives them hope. So many, many people I've met are faith-filled, whatever denomination that encompasses. Many of them are lonely, which you don't often see because they have a lot of bravado on the streets. But they're lonely because they don't have families around them. And they don't have any friends around them. Friends come and go. They don't have too many stable friends. And all of them, like all of us, want to believe that they're loved by somebody. So you might be wondering, where do they live? You see them during the day, of course, in this area. You see them flying signs. You see them huddled into the food places. But where are they the rest of the day? They're in lots of different places. They live in their cars, which sometimes you can see where their trucks you can see parked at Walmart. They live on rooftops of the second or third floor building. I have a friend who did that for years, and he carried a ladder, put the ladder against the building, he climbed up, he pulled the ladder up, he slept on top of this building, put the ladder, and then put it down in the morning, and he hit the ladder. Some sleep in alleys. A lot of them sleep in alleys. Some sleep in the woods with a tent or without a tent. Some sleep in the shelter for maybe like the arch for maybe a night or two if they get a spot. Some sleep on a friend's sofa surfing. Usually that doesn't last very long for either parties. Some sleep in a parking garage. Garages around here. Some sleep in cardboard boxes, like you see, like my friend John did, who I'm happy to say is off the streets. For 3 years he lived in a cardboard box off Cesar Chavez. Some sleep on the sidewalk, just like you see there, or public park bench. And lately what I've been noticing, some people who are homeless are building little, what I call, patchwork houses out of cardboard, things they find in a dumpster, shopping carts, and tarps. And most of these little cardboard patchwork houses are found under bridges or under overpasses. And they're very creative. They are incredibly creative. I was there around Halloween time, and this just touched my heart. Every one of those little patchwork houses had a pumpkin. Didn't they say they are us? They wanted to celebrate. And they're so clever. Some of them actually have two rooms. There's many different places that they live, and some of them, as I say, are looking for permanent housing. So, why is this important? Why did Ellen and St. David's invite me to speak about homelessness? You can see a young girl, old man. It's important. important because you all know that we're part of the family of man. And whatever we do, however we treat the least among us, says who we are as a society, as a state, and as individuals. And it's also important because at some point in my life, or in your life, or in your children's life, your grandchildren's life, your friend's life, there may come a time when someone you know, someone you love, is homeless. Either from losing a job, from an illness, from an accident, or from addiction. Many, many times people have come up to me, people just like you and me, and they know I care about the homeless, and they'll say, please pray for my brother. I don't know where he is, but I know he's in the streets. Please pray for my daughter. I don't know where she is, but she's on the streets. Please pray for my father and my mother. So this homelessness cuts through all socioeconomic groups. And it's good to know it's not just them, it's us. This is us. Homelessness is us. It's also important because I think about St. Teresa of Avila. And she said, Christ has no body on earth, no hands, no feet on earth, but yours. So when I go out to be among the homeless, now that I'm retired, my goal is 2 days a week. Doesn't have to be all day, but I try to be with homeless people at least 2 days a week. And I have such a simple mind and a simple little mantra. When I go out, I say to myself, hands and feet, hands and feet. And I realize that's all I'm called to do, just to be there, just to be a presence. Also, you are all church people, and I think you know this quote from Matthew 25. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you a drink? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did this for the least of these my brothers, you did it for me. So that's probably the most important reason why we're doing it. So what can we do? This is a big problem. I think my advice would be try to see the homeless people around here and anywhere. Try to see them as individuals, not as numbers in a study that's released by ECHO. Not as a stranger on a street corner throwing a sign, but as individuals. When I was on the streets many, many times, for short, long periods of time, that was the hardest thing for me. It wasn't carrying my backpack. It wasn't wondering where I would sleep. It wasn't wondering, worried about safety, which I never did. But I couldn't stand being dissed. And it happened to me. Looking at me like I didn't matter, like I wasn't a human being. And one time I was walking downtown on the sidewalk, and honestly, after 24 hours, anybody looks homeless. So I'm walking downtown looking pretty bad. And this man's coming the other direction, and he saw me. He literally stepped off the sidewalk, went across the street, so he wouldn't have to come contact with me. I remember being on Congress Avenue early one morning, 6 o'clock one morning, after several nights on the streets, and nobody would give me eye contact. And I realized these were the same people that a week before, a week after, would see me on the streets, dressed like you, dressed like me, and they'd say, hi, have a good day. But when I was on the streets, no eye contact, no acknowledgement that I existed. So I think that's, if you could just do that, just acknowledge that they exist. My phrase is, let them see you, see them. So how do you do that? I think the most important thing to do is, if you're in the car, give a wave. Give a smile at them. If you're walking, put out your hand and say hi. I'm Charlie. How's your day going? Doesn't have to be any more depth than that. Let them know that you see them. Give them a cup of coffee on a cold day, cold morning. bottle of water on a hot afternoon, and always can have socks. You can get secondhand clothing, you can get backpacks, but you cannot get socks and underwear. So that's kind of my mission. I always give socks, and several times I give underwear. Because it's just, no place sells or gives away secondhand socks and underwear. So basically just reach out to them, and you will be the one that will benefit. So the future. When I think about all of you, when I think about St. David's, I say to myself, those people are lucky. You're so fortunate to be a neighbor of all these homeless people right around you. They are your neighbors. And you are looking at me saying that lady's crazy. They urinate in our parking lot. They shoot up by the dumpster attached to our building. They litter our city streets. They loiter on our steps. How can this be a gift? And I think it's a gift because this is where you will see, this is where you will meet God. You are right in the center. And like you, I'm a religious churchgoer. I love liturgies. I love sacred music. I like homilies. But I never feel closer to God than when I look in the face of someone who's homeless, particularly somebody who's ill, unattractive, desperate, drooling, demanding. That's when we see Christ. So what can you do? You're doing so much here at St. David's. Please support the Trinity Center, and I'll give you a tiny quote from my book, thanking the Trinity Center. I'm thanking them. The same goes for Trinity Center of Austin, an outgrowth of concern for parishioners of St. David's Episcopal Church that cares for homeless people in the downtown area. I was introduced to you by a homeless friend. Most of my friends are homeless. And you treated me with extraordinary kindness when I attended a Monday Women to Women's Breakfast, Birthday Celebration, and Clothing Pantry. For these few hours while living on the streets, I felt cherished as a woman. You served tea and coffee in china cups, some chipped but still lovely, fresh fruit, tiny muffins, and homemade birthday cake, which surely said somebody cares. So please support the Trinity Center. I'm not from this parish, but I value the Trinity Center. Then I encourage you to volunteer in some way for the homeless cause and do something that makes sense to you. It could be being on a board at your church. It could be being on a civic board. It could be meaning bringing in clothes to the boxes in the hall that goes to the secondhand clothing that goes to Trinity Center. Read some books about homelessness, whether they're studies, whether they're personal narratives. And most importantly, I think, get to know at least one homeless person so that you can see the world through that person's eyes. You'll never be the same. And then what can we all do? Pray for them. They are our brothers and sisters in Christ. So pray for them and pray for all of us that we will have our hearts opened. So thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you. Now, questions? I'm happy to answer anything. How are we doing on the time now? Are we good?
We're away.
Yes,
I got 10. Good.
Yeah, we're good. Okay. Who's brave enough to ask a question? Yes, ma'am.
What about the community village? How has that worked? Has that been an important piece of...
It's worked. It's worked well. They're going to double it. I think what's really important about that village is not only do they give people housing, but they help them acclimate. Just like I was talking about Laura in that first slide. She didn't have a living community. She had so long to live on the streets. And it's everything from what do you do with your trash to one homeless guy I knew who had been in prison for 17 years. And worked in HEB shopping, and he took my shopping cart and he sent it flying. And I said, nope. I said, Jose, the first step in citizenship is putting the shopping cart away. I mean, dumb little things like that. And that's what they teach it. So you need maybe not just a social worker, but a community that teaches you this is how you live in community. And they have rules just like you, rules in your condo association, which is important. So you just can't put somebody in housing, like somebody they put Lauren in, and expect it's going to work well. It doesn't always work well. So I think you're doing a super job. What else? What other questions do you have? Yes, ma'am.
One of the big controversies is about giving people cash versus giving people food, or now I know socks.
Socks.
how do you feel about the whole cash and people who are begging on the freeway and entry and exit ramps?
Good for you. That question was good to us. I don't even need to address it, but I wrestled with that. And I have many times I went down the street. I finally came to grips, and I'll tell you how my brand helped help me. You have to look at it that I'm giving a gift. If it's money, say I'm giving a dollar or $5, I'm giving a gift. If it's a gift, there's no strings attached. I know when I experience mine that maybe that money is going to buy a fix, but it also may be that I'm going to buy a breakfast or maybe to give to a sick partner. I don't know. I cannot be that judge. All I can do is give freely from my heart. And once I figure that out, oh, I was released from all that burden of guilt. I do give cash. I tend to give it to people who I know are truly homeless, and you can tell. You can absolutely tell. Bad teeth. They don't go to the dentist. Sort of weather-beaten skin, because they've been out in all kinds of weather. Probably handicapped. If they're old, like me, absolutely. They're not going to be able to get a job. If they're young and hardy and they've got a bucket, I don't give because I don't know where that money's going. You have to trust your instincts, but sometimes I do give cash. But I never worry about it. It's like if you give $20 to your grandchild or to your child, you don't say, gee, I wonder if they're going to buy a bad video game. Or anything. You just, if it's a gift, it's a gift that's given from love. So I don't know if that helps you, but do what's in your heart. Yes, sir.
Can you give us any insights into the cadre of homeless that we see at street corners and intersections collecting money? Can you think of that as a subset, or is it just part of the whole melange?
I think it's part of the whole group. Now, there's a group that always says they're collecting for an organization. I don't trust them, because I think money's going to some, I don't know, organization. And they usually have buckets, so that's my clue. Don't go to buckets. But if you see somebody asking for money, we would call them flyers, because we usually find a sign, desperate, need food, that kind of thing. Most of those people are individuals. Some need it, obviously, for food. Some need it for a fix. There's lots of different reasons. It's the same thing as this woman said, you just have to trust you've got. Look them in the eye and see, do they really need it? And sometimes, I don't give anything. I have a conversation. And that may be the nicest thing you can do. I wrote about that chapter in the book about Freddie. And I was at an intersection. He was flying a sign. I just rolled my window down and I said, just visiting, no money. And that's what he wanted. And he said, I am so lonely. And I said, what's talking? We talked maybe for 5 minutes. And that night, Freddie committed suicide by an overdose. So sometimes that conversation is a whole lot more important than $5 or $1. And I've learned that too. So listen to your own heart. You'll know what's right. Yes, sir.
A couple of comments. I volunteer at Trinity Center every Thursday morning.
God bless you.
And one of the most startling experiences I've had was when coming through the line one morning was a young man, very well groomed, not like most of the people we see in the center. And he said to me, he said, sir, do you think what you're doing is helping people get homes, or are you just sustaining homelessness? And, I didn't know how to respond to that kind of a challenge for a minute. So I took a deep breath and I said, all I can tell you is I know why I'm here, and that's to serve my neighbor. I said, I can't speak for everything else that's going on in Austin. And the other observation I've had is that how many of these people are transient. They'll come through here and say, where are you from? And they say, well, I just got in from L.A. yesterday. Or I was in New Orleans over the weekend. and they hitchhiked their way here, or, you know, jumped on the train or something. And how many of them just move from place to place to place is amazing to me.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you, Catherine. It really is important. And we don't know why we're doing these things. Why am I out in the streets? I'm called to do it. I'm called to love my brother. I'm not solving one thing about homelessness. That's somebody else's job. So I think you have to decide, why are we doing what we're doing? And yes, there are a tremendous number of people who come into the city, back and forth. As I said, prison's one big thing. They're just dropped off here, and they don't know the city at all. And then all those other reasons why people are on the streets. There is a stable population, though, of people that I know, like I see them, I say, I'll see them in the HEB, how are you? I don't even know all their names. But there's a real core of stable people who are still here. But just giving them a house is not going to solve it. Yes, sir.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm a huge believer in the power of nature. If I was on the streets, which I don't feel called to do, I'd be under a tree or, in the, you know, I. And one of the things that I see is, and we live very close to here, so we live kind of in this problem center, is when you drive up and down and they're sleeping on cement next to a wall, and that to me, it seems like is so much less humane than if there was a camp. Just with, you know, that it was, you know, people go camping all the time for the power of that nature to get away from it. And it seems like there are so many things that bring the homeless here. Most of the services, and I understand the Trinity Center followed the people, but are in downtown. And they're where there's only cement and where somebody else urinated yesterday. And lots of people who are going to feel affronted instead of being, you know, out in a more natural setting. And I've always wondered if that's ever been, you know, if they thought, well, the least we could do is get these people out of a cement jungle into a more park-like setting, a safer setting where they knew it was safe, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, community
right.
First is about physical housing as well. But if there's, instead of pitching their tent on an underpass, if they were pitching a tent on a field or one of the many empty lots the city of Austin owns or something, you know.
Oh, you hit like 55, you know, points.
I'm sorry.
No, just, I mean, you're so right. The services are here, so people, they pretty much can stay in the city. Also, a lot of our city folks, they don't really know the country. There is a large group, though, that actually sleeps in our green belt. And some tents, but some not tents. And some of those people won't even come into the city. I know some people that didn't know I would go to the city. It's not safe. So, and at Community First, which is what you're referring to, they do have their little houses, but they have a garden, they have chickens, they have sheep, goats. It's all about being outside and being in more of a nature setting. But I don't know how to solve those issues, but I'm with you on them. Yes, sir.
So they're making changes to the arch where they're trying to take each person and figure out why are you in this situation, what specific things, because there's not one answer, everybody's different.
No.
Do you get comments from people? Because the arch before was just like a lottery, like maybe I'll be able to sleep there tonight, maybe I'll be on the sidewalk. Do you get any feedback because you're talking to folks? How effective that's going to be?
I think that's what we have to do. This current arch right in your neighborhood is very different from the original arch when I first moved here. It was in a different location. It was smaller. It was controlled. It was chaotic, but it was controlled chaos. This is not controlled. You all know the arch. And I'm saying that from an outsider, but I'm also saying that from an insider. I have many, many, many homeless friends who will not go to the arch because, in their words, it's dangerous. There's drugs there, there's bed bugs there, there's assaults there, people take their stuff. And so we need to turn it around. We need to figure out a way to make it work. And I know they're trying a new design, which I think is important. And if you look at this drive down 7, I mean, that breaks my heart, but I make myself do it every once in a while. During the week, you see those people, they're sleeping on the sidewalk on one side and then on 7th Street. They're desperate, and I do go there a fair amount. I was there on Valentine's Day.
It's right over here.
Yeah.
You look at it, you can see it from
exactly,
there.
Exactly, exactly. And that system is not working. And so we need to figure out what is working. And you're right, no one solution is going to fit everybody. Somebody's mentally handicapped, somebody's physically handicapped, someone's on drugs, someone's alcohol, well, abusing. So there's just so many reasons why they're homeless, and they need a lot of different solutions to make it work.
Well, that's what they said they're going to do, but I don't know if that's really going to happen, because they cut the number of beds, but then each person's supposed to actually be able to stay there and get specific people that are helping them, like they did at Salvation Army, where you actually have somebody that you talk to, and they figure out, you have a relative here, or you don't, or this is what you need, or you need to be back on your medicines for your mental health problems.
It's very complicated, even the numbers, which I'm now wrestling with. I gave a talk and someone said, how many homeless people do we have in Austin? I said, well, the latest point count, which at one time of year they make a count, but you know. And 2018, it was 2,147 people. And somebody said, well, that doesn't sound like a lot of people. I said, no, it doesn't to me either. And then this Washington Statesman came out with an article that said they were redesigning it, and the number they used was 7,500. So I called the Statesman, talked to that writer. She said, I got that number from Echo. So I called Echo. I said, we've got a problem here. We want to know, we who are citizens of Austin, want to know how many homeless people there are. And your point of count is 2,147. Now you're printing, because they printed, it's 7,500. And they said, we realize we've got a discrepancy here. So we don't really know how many people we have. Which is, I'm the first one to admit, isn't it?
I have a friend who lives in Maryland, and she said she saw on some news show that communities in Texas were busing their homeless to Austin, and they named Austin in the news show. And she said, what's going on there?
I think people do come to Austin from other cities in Texas.
No, but it seemed like it was a planned effort.
That I don't know about. But
I was very surprised. I had not heard that.
We're a hospitable city. Yeah, we are, and there are servers, and people are kind. And I do know that prisoners are dropped here.
I want to tell you one nice thing that happened. I lived downtown. I was on the street coming home when I was coming toward a homeless man. And I heard a voice behind me saying, hi, so-and-so, and it sounded very bright. And I turned around, and it was a uniformed policeman.
Yes.
And it just made me feel good that he knew him by name, that he addressed him, and he said it in a very friendly way, like he'd seen a friend.
They're training our police, which is great. Didn't happen 10 years ago. There's a concerted effort to train the policemen to help them, not get them tickets, but to get them to the services they need. So, and it's a program, so I love it. Good, glad you're working. Yes?
Was Laura transgender?
Yes, she was.
And I wonder how much of a problem is that, as far as...
It's a big problem. The gay, lesbian, it's a big problem. Laura dressed like a woman and had some surgeries, but she was never assaulted because she was so genuine, she was so willing to help, she was so honest, this is who I am, that she was never assaulted. But it's hard. And I serve at an Episcopal church on Friday nights called Home Cook Fridays, and I don't feed, I'm the waitress, but the UT students cook the food, and we serve about 100 to 200 people, and I see transgender people there a fair amount, or gay people, and it's hard. They can be targeted, definitely in that population. Yes, ma'am?
Ginny, we're almost out of time, but before we close, would you tell the story of how your book got named?
Sure. There's 34 stories in the book. 33 of them have already appeared in the Statesman. So even if you buy the book, there's other stuff around here, even if you read the stories. But the only story that never appeared in the Statesman, because I didn't submit it, but it's a book titled You Are My Brother. So I retired in 2008 for the first time as a school head, and at the end of the party that they had for me, which was very nice, it was a party for all children, faculty, parents, so hundreds and hundreds of people. And as the party was ending, I said to the woman who was organizing, I said, could I have the food? Libby used to that with me, and I said, sure. So they packaged it all up. And I came downtown to the Arch by myself, which they say you shouldn't do, but I always do. And I said to the guys, mostly guys, I said, I have the best food tonight. Let you see what I have. But I need your help. You have to get in line. And grumpy, but they do it. It helps you, your principal, because you don't have control. So, and sometimes I just stop and say, get in line. And they get in line. Okay, I can go. So they're in line, and I promised them I would make each one of them a fajito to order. So I had all the best stuff. Everything you can imagine for a top-rate Mexican restaurant. And I'm making individual fajitas. And the man came up to me. I'm on the right. Usually I'm on this side. He came on the left, and he, really angry man. And he said, who are you, and what are you doing here? Praise the Holy Spirit. I looked him in the eye, and I said, aren't you my brother? And he just melted. And he said, yes. And then he went out and left. So it's those moments where I realized this is what I'm called to do. I'm just called to be with them. Not that I know how to do it, that I have one advantage besides being a principal, that I'm a little lady. And so when I'm out with the homeless people, they're never afraid of me. They know that I can't possibly hurt them. And so that's my little secret, my school moment secret, is that I'm not afraid of them and they're not afraid of me. So it works really well. So you are my brother. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.